Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Wednesday, November 30th. Today, we're hearing the second of two episodes with Sun reporters Jen Brown and Olivia Prentzel, who, alongside colleagues, reported a series of stories on the challenges of the foster and adoption system in Colorado, and particularly on failed adoptions. Before we begin, we'd like to thank our friends and sponsors at Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy can help you find ways to keep your home or business running smoothly while reducing energy use and saving you money. Find everyday tips for using less energy and simple ways to manage your energy budget at xcelenergy.com. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. The federal government's highest security prison, known as Supermax, and located near Florence in Fremont County, admitted its first inmates on this date in 1994. Nicknamed the Alcatraz of the Rockies, it secures the nation's worst offenders under lock and key. The U.S. Congress approved the United States Penitentiary Administrative Maximum Facility in 1989 and designated Fremont County, already home to several prisons, to house it. Residents wanted the economically valuable facility so badly that they bought and donated 400 acres to the federal government for the site. Governor Roy Romer participated at groundbreaking ceremonies in July 1990. For the next 4 years, hundreds of workers erected the forbidding, triangular $60 million structure on the Sagebrush Flats south of Florence. Concrete walls, fences, and 14 rows of razor wire protect civilians from the men locked within the institution, as do guards watching from towers, trucks, and helicopters. Residents of Supermax are a who's who of mayhem and misery. The roster has included drug cartel kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, Russian spy Robert Hansen, the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, Oklahoma City bombers Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, 9/11 terrorist Zacharias Moussaoui, and more. The United States has no more infamous address than Supermax. Before we continue, a quick message. The Colorado Sun invites you to attend Closing the Gap, a conversation with Colorado's Black community about home ownership. Join the virtual discussion to hear from expert panels about getting the Black community to a place where they have better access to home ownership. The event is free, will be streamed and recorded on December 1st from 5:30 to 6:45 p.m. Learn more at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Welcome back to the Daily Sun Up Podcast, Colorado. I'm Carol Wood, guiding you through today's conversation. I'm grateful to be here with you today. I'm also grateful to be visiting again with Jen Brown and Olivia Prentzel, who were part of a team that produced a series of stories for us on foster care and adoption in the state of Colorado. And today we're going to talk about a couple other aspects about disrupted and dissolved adoptions. Welcome back, Jen and Olivia.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, Carol. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And so, yeah, in our previous episode, we talked a lot about the experiences that these children and families have, and just really years of, Jen, you described years of interest that you had in this topic. And then finally, in the last couple years, laws changed in the state of Colorado, a lot of open records requests that you were able to make. And then Jen and Olivia and our colleague Shannon Najmabadi, editor Dave Krause, and our photographer Olivia Sun, you all spent months working on this series that we started running on November 14th on coloradosun.com. Today, can you tell us a little bit about the reasons for these disrupted and dissolved adoptions and maybe some of the numbers associated with those reasons?
Sure. Yeah. One of the many open records requests that we sent to the state was to find out why these adoptions break up, like you said. And it was really surprising to me, like the number one reason that came back was child's behavior problem. Like that's how it's coded in the state's computer system. And, you know, we talked to quite a few child advocates and even, you know, advocates for adoptive families, and we're like, well, it's kind of a poor way to say it, you know, because through our reporting, what we found out is, you know, yes, maybe at the basic level, you can call it child's behavior problem. But what it really is like this lack of resources for the families to deal with the behavioral problems that are obviously going to be there when someone's been abused and neglected, and also, you know, might have reactive attachment disorder, also might be going through something they call adoption-related loss, which is basically the grief that a person who is adopted feels, and they're losing somebody that maybe they don't even know. Maybe they were a baby even when they were adopted, but there's still a grief in not knowing who that person was. So all of those things can like manifest in bad behavior and in really bad behavior. Like the symptoms of reactive attachment disorder, they're pretty frightening. I mean, they were like lying, cheating, stealing, being destructive to the house, but also, you know, terrorizing the family pet, you know, hurting people. I talked to one mom whose adopted daughter like took a knife and slashed holes in her, in the mother's mattress, you know, sort of somewhat homicidal, you know. So I guess in the beginning I was thinking, how horrible are these parents that they would give up on a kid and give them back? But when you sit down and you talk to so many of them and they share these emotional stories, but they have a lot of commonalities, you know, like one mom was saying that her adoptive son sexually assaulted one of the other children. There's just a lot of issues that are going on there. And I think basically the point is that you can blame it on child's behavior problem, which is very basic, or you can say, wait, where are we failing in the child welfare system, but also in the mental health system and the behavioral health system, that these kids aren't getting treatment for what they have suffered.
Yes. And the how everything is intertwined, it sounds like, is the state now working more and more, and the individual counties also that really deal with these probably through the court system. And I'm sure that there are CASA systems in different counties that also try to help deal with these kind of court appointed supervisors for children to help guide them through the court system. What's the interplay of these now and some of the solutions looking forward?
Sure. Well, the statewide nonprofit called Raise the Future, they're funded by the state. They're definitely looking to tackle what Jen had just talked about, the child's behavior problem. But how they're doing it is they're teaching parents how a child's brain may just have developed differently because they've been, you know, experienced very traumatic situations for so many years when they were so young. I attended one of the trainings, and a facilitator, she was speaking to about a dozen parents and caregivers. And what she said was she knew that everyone there, they were there because they really cared and they had tried so many things and they just didn't know what to do. And a lot of these parents are in situations where the behavior they see from their children are just really scary and they just, you know, don't have the tools to help them. So that is a training that's offered around the state that's definitely looking to, I guess, help parents meet their children's needs and, you know, help them de-escalate some of the behavior problems that they're seeing. As far as counties go, every county can provide services in a variety of ways. It's up to them. But we did find in Boulder County, they have a team that proactively reaches out to families after they've finalized their adoptions, and they call and ask, you know, what they need. It's a very proactive approach, which is different than a lot of other places in Colorado. I spoke to the director there, and she said that there is this fear among some parents to ask for help after they've completed their adoption. You know, there's this fear that, you know, if they reach out for help to the county human services department, that they think their child may be taken away. So they really try to make themselves seen in the community. They have events at farms, at ice skating rinks, and they just want more people to know about the services that are available. And then we also did learn that, you know, Colorado is just starting to look at disrupted and dissolved adoptions, and they're a bit behind some other states, Minnesota and Georgia, for example. Minnesota has been looking at this data in their state since 2019, and last year, Georgia created a unit to look at why adoptions are disrupted and dissolved and, you know, looking for solutions for that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one of the things that stands out also is the fear that actually must be part of the adoptive parents' experience if they don't want to be seen as a failure, or like you said, having these children returned or taken from them. And their willingness to ask for help, you know, that's probably something that we really don't all think about, right? In terms of the experience of the parents as well, especially if they have a child that's challenging based on trauma and other mental health issues. So Georgia and Minnesota, now Colorado, that still seems like a very narrow swath of states looking at this. Did you gain any sense in your reporting of why there's so little movement in terms of trying to repair these systems?
I think that really at a basic level, they just weren't keeping track of these numbers. It was like, oh, we found this child, they're forever a family, they're adopted, they've left the foster care system, yay. And I think that the federal government said, it's really been like 8 or 9 years ago, like, hey, we should really keep track of what happens next. But as the federal government does sometimes, they didn't say like, here's some money for that so you can upgrade your systems, or here's how we'll keep the data. They didn't really do any follow-up, and so states just didn't really do it. And I do want to go back to what you're saying before, Carol, about, you know, the fear these parents feel. And I mean, I just thought something that was astounding that I heard several times, and so did Olivia and Shannon, from parents, is that system for getting mental health care, I mean, it's so broken. We all know that. But time and again, we would hear from these parents that they're like, basically, they don't know what to do anymore. They're fearing for their safety, the safety of other kids in their family. And so these adopted kids would sometimes end up at a mental health facility. And then, you know, they'd be there for 24 hours or 72 hours. And the facility would say, okay, come pick up the child. Well, after doing this multiple times and nothing changing, several mothers I talked to said, nope, not going to pick them up. Because they knew they had been, I mean, sometimes they knew, sometimes they were just taking a gamble, but that the only way to like get them admitted into some kind of residential facility that they needed was to say, I refuse to come get them. And these parents were willing to be charged with child abandonment, and they were threatened with it. Some had cases opened against them for, you know, like a child abuse and neglect case opened on them because they refused to pick up their adopted kid. So, I mean, that whole thing is so much drama to try to get the proper care. So the fear in that community is real. I just want to say, like, they, you know, many families were like, oh my gosh, the only way I can get help for this child is through the local child welfare division, yet I may end up in jail.
Right. And again, the interplay of all of these systems, and then also, you know, sometimes we have a mental health system that isn't always set up to treat severe trauma or severe trauma among youth, for sure. And it just seems like the interplay of all of these different things is almost overwhelming for the system, for the kids, for the parents. You mentioned Olivia, Georgia and Minnesota. Do you have a sense of how any other countries compare to how the U.S. or these three states handles this sort of situation?
I don't think we know about what other countries are doing to keep track of kids that are adopted. But what we did learn is that people in Colorado who have done international adoptions, oftentimes, well, I shouldn't say often, we don't know how often. Sometimes those kids end up in Colorado's foster care system. And we did meet a couple of families who that had happened to. You know, one family who was adopted to 3-year-olds from Russia. Another was a young man who was adopted from Ukraine, and he ended up going into foster care in Arizona, not Colorado. Anyway, point being, like, the numbers that we were able to get only show children who were in foster care in Colorado and came back to foster care in Colorado. So you have all these other kids who were adopted internationally, or maybe in some cases adopted through, you know, a private adoption that didn't involve any child welfare. And they end up also back in Colorado's foster care system. So just to say, there's a lot that we still don't know about how this is working. And those families that adopt internationally, they even have fewer supports, it seems, because, you know, there's no access to Medicaid for their children. You know, in Colorado, when you adopt a foster child, that child can have Medicaid for the rest of their childhood. You know, no matter how much money the family adopting them has, this kid can still get that pretty basic level of insurance, but at least they still have it and access to some therapies. That's not the case when you adopt a child from Russia and it turns out they need like a lifetime of therapy.
Wow. Got it, Jen. Thank you for breaking that down. What is next? I know that you will continue to follow this. What's next at the state level and at the county levels for working to support this system, all parts of the system, in a better way?
Well, from our perspective, we're planning to try to keep this at the forefront of conversation. You know, we hope that people took notice of the four-day series, people that are in charge of making policy. I hope that when the legislature comes back in session in January, maybe this will be something that they could look at and figure out how we could do better, how we can support these families. One thing that's already in the works, stemming back from a report from the Child Protection Ombudsman for Colorado that came out about 4 years or 6 years ago, maybe it was. Anyway, it basically was looking at the adoption subsidies that families receive, payments that they get after they adopt a child from foster care, and really pointed out some massive inequities in that process. Like, you could live in one county and get absolutely nothing, and you could live in another county and they might give you $3,000 a month. Yeah. And so there has been work being done for the last couple of years to try to fix that inequity. They're rolling out, they call it a new tool. It's basically like a guideline of like a questionnaire or a guideline that you would sit down and use with a family that would be uniform across Colorado. So at least there was equitable treatment no matter where you lived. But there's no new money for that. It doesn't mean people are going to get more money. It just means that some people are going to get more money and some people are going to get less money, but that will be an improvement to how it's going right now.
Right. So that maybe at least there would be some parity to it county by county. Well, thanks for dropping by again, both of you, Jen and Olivia, and to Shannon Najmabadi and Dave Krause and Olivia Sun for contributing to this series. And our readers can go to coloradosun.com and look at all of these stories on Colorado's child foster care system and the adoption system. And if you have questions about this or about other topics of the podcast, drop us an email at podcast@coloradosun.com. And thanks, Jen and Olivia, and to everyone else who produced today's podcast, including our production partners at Pirate Audio. Have a wonderful day out there, and I sincerely hope that you can join us for the next Daily Sun Up.
Read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. A Colorado grand jury says a Clear Creek officer's decision to remove Christian Glass from his car directly led to his death on a dirt road near Silver Plume. According to the indictment, sheriff's deputies Kyle Gould and Andrew Bune had no probable cause to remove the 22-year-old from the vehicle while he was having a mental health episode. Bune, who shot Glass 5 times, was indicted on charges of second-degree murder, official misconduct, and reckless endangerment. Gould, who made the decision to remove Glass, was indicted on charges of criminally negligent homicide and reckless endangerment. A Colorado Sun analysis of election results refutes Congresswoman Lauren Boebert's claim that other Republican candidates may have dragged her down as she barely won re-election in her GOP-leaning district. All but one Republican candidate for major statewide office outperformed Boebert in Colorado's 3rd congressional district this year. While gubernatorial candidate Heidi Ganahl may have fared worse in the 3rd district than Boebert, every other GOP candidate won by a larger margin than the congresswoman in the district, even as they all went on to lose their races statewide by double digits. Coloradans who buy health insurance on their own are creeping up on some deadlines to enroll in the open market. The Sun's health reporter John Ingold has compiled a guide to help navigate the enrollment period before the December 15th and January 15th deadlines. Suggestions from industry experts include checking Connect for Health to see if you are eligible for federal subsidies, and don't just shop for the plan with the lowest price premium. But mostly, they stress that people should reach out for help when they get stuck. For more information on all these stories, visit our website, www.coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. The Colorado Sun is nonpartisan and completely independent. We're always dedicated to telling the in-depth stories we need today more than ever. And the Sun is supported by readers and listeners like you. Right now, you can head to coloradosun.com and become a member, starting at $5 per month. And if you bump it up to $20 per month, you'll get access to our politics newsletter, The Unaffiliated, as well as our outdoors newsletter, The Outsider, and our new health and environment newsletter, The Temperature. All three exclusive newsletters delivered to your inbox every week.